And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast on a Thursday afternoon, where I am thrilled on a number of levels to be joined by former NBA All-Star and current lots of important things that we'll get to, the one and only Caron Butler. How are you doing, sir?
I'm blessed, man. No complaints. How you doing?
Hanging in. It's all we can do. Hang in.
Absolutely.
So here's how this podcast happened. About a year and a half ago, I went to an event in New York put on by the Vera Institute of Justice, which is a nonprofit that tackles mass incarceration and policing and police brutality and all of the things that are in the news right now. And I saw a woman from the NBA's public relations department, and we kind of had this moment where we looked at each other like, wait, what are you doing here? Wait, what are you doing here? And I told her that about 10 years ago, when I was thinking of getting out of journalism, I had covered the criminal justice system and become very passionate about it. And I almost took a job at Vera in the PR department there. And she said, well, you know, we have a player who's going to about to become really involved with Vera. And I said, well, who is it? And she said, Caron Butler. I said, well, Caron Butler is a legend, man. At some point, we're going to have this discussion. And now is the time to have this discussion. So I appreciate you coming on.
No problem, bro. And appreciate that high praise, man. I'm going to have to take you on the road with me everywhere we go.
Well, there you go. Well, let's start with that, because your story, you know, when you tell your story and when people tell your story, I think there tends to be a focus on the more dramatic elements of it, right? Like, he was dealing drugs when he was 12 and he was in jail. But your story to me is actually a story of hope, and especially what you're doing now. And I want to start there. One of the things you have done for Vera is you went and visited a correctional facility for, I believe, under 18 juveniles in Connecticut, in Cheshire, Connecticut, that was using this innovative program called TRUE, T-R-U-E. It's an acronym for something. That they had learned about in Germany. And you spoke to those kids about their experiences and your experience. So tell the people who are listening what that program is and why you were passionate enough about what it stands for to go there and visit.
Well, thanks again for having me on this platform. It's a pleasure and an honor. And, you know, I was always thinking about what I've been through as a young male in Racine, Wisconsin, and what a lot of, you know, people go through in the black and brown community, disenfranchised, and what they are exposed to immediately. Systemic oppression and all these things. And immediately every experience that I talked about, and I penned it in the letter in the Players Tribune, is that you're stripped away from your human dignity and your rights immediately when you're incarcerated. And one of the things that I always realize as well is that most of the time you're not rehabilitated. You know, you go to corrections and 9 times out of 10 people go to be better criminals. You know, they learn things that they didn't know before. You're exposed to the learning and the education from people that have more severe crimes and things like that. So for the first time, I went to visit L.A. County Jail, and this was at the time Suge Knight was in there down here at the county. I went to Rikers Island. I went to RCI, Green Bay, all these locations. But the TRUE unit was one that's in Connecticut that I never got a chance to go to. But I heard about this program that they adapted in Germany, and I wanted to see how did it operate. So immediately we go in, and it was something that was very unfamiliar. Inmates was walking around free. They had their clothes on. They had chores and laundry duty. They had classes. They had barbershop, culinary stuff. The library was like a really nice library with great reads. They also had financial literacy classes that was taking place. And immediately I was just like, this is like something I've never seen before. But here's the real thing that's going to blow you away is that they all policed themselves. They didn't need any reinsurance because they felt like they was being better. They was becoming a better version of them, the inmates. And what I say is, and people be like, when someone go to jail, that's their problem. It's not just their problem. It's our problem as well, because if they don't get rehabilitated, they're going to come out worse off, and they can be a threat to you. They can be a threat to someone you love. and they are still part of our society. So that's what I learned at the True Unit, and it was a learning experience for me, and it was powerful. And I always tell people about that unit and some of the remarkable players and people that I met that come from that unit. It's a kid they did a CNN special on, Shaquem Diggs. He's in college. So he's an honor student. He's doing all these amazing things, and he's a product of the True Unit. So the system work, 80%, 85% of them never return back. It's just amazing. It's amazing, concept that they put together.
But the larger point you're trying to make here is that this is a facility that has taken what prison is supposed to be, thrown it all away or most of it away, and said, we are going to focus on preparing these people to reenter society on every level, to make them more employable, to give them the skills they're going to need to function, and to get them ready to come back out instead of just you're in, you sit in a jail cell for a while and you come back out, right? But that's it. It's a completely different focus.
I think that has to be the point of emphasis. Like, immediately when people go to jail and you cast them away from society and you don't rehabilitate them. So what do you think? Like, right now, what we're dealing with in the midst of a pandemic is, you know, trauma that has gone centuries without being addressed. Like, this happened. Like, it's been years of unaddressed trauma, you know, centuries. So, and people say, well, how would you get here? I'll tell you how we got here, and we can go down that path. And when you look at correctional facilities, that's, you know, it's oppressed, it's systemic, it's the whole system is just fractured, and you put these individuals in a fractured system and expect them to come out and be a better version of them. It doesn't happen like that. Locked down 23 hours a day and being out for an hour for rec and, you know, being able to take a shower and things like that and back to your cell. Like, what do you think that's going to do? What does that rehabilitate? I was part of that system, you know, and it done something to me. Only I had love and people that really poured into me and sacrificed, where I was able to get it. Whatever it was, it registered. I got it, and I addressed my traumas, and I came out better from it. But it's a lot of people that don't have those support groups.
Well, what you had, one of the heroes of your story is your mom. And I reading back on your clips, there were two details about your mom that I read your essays and some stuff about you that really just like really moved me to the point of the one that moved me to the point of almost tears when you stop and picture it in your head is I don't think it was the first time you had gotten arrested, but it was one of the big ones. It was one of the ones, it might have been when they found the stuff at school.
Yeah.
That she followed the police car to the police station, which is like, okay, that's what a mother does. And then you're there overnight and she slept in her car overnight in a parking lot because she didn't want you to feel, she wanted you to know someone was there. And that hit me. Is that true?
Yeah. And I actually saw my mom from my cell. So I'm watching and I'll never forget. She was just like, I didn't want you to feel like, I know that you disappointed us, but I didn't want you to feel like we gave up on you. And when she said that, that was just like, all right, I got to get right. You know what I mean? But that support is what you need. And it's going to come in waves. You're going to probably pivot back to your old habits or whatever, because psychologically you continue to recycle the same thoughts and habits. But if you don't have people that love you and that's there, that's connected with you, or the system that you're now part of that have some type of plan and something really in play in order for you to really rehabilitate yourself and come out better, bro, you're not going to make it. You're going to come out the same way and you're going to be worse. And that is the problem.
So one of the what's happening right now with the protests and the focus on police brutality, it stemmed from three. I think there's been so many of these cases that it's absolutely tragic and disgusting to think about. But the three recent ones that really galvanized people are Ahmaud Arbery jogging. Okay, Breonna Taylor sleeping in her house, and of course George Floyd murdered on someone's camera phone. We all saw it, right? And so that galvanized this movement. Everyone's angry in the streets. What's brought me hope, even more hope than I had a week ago, was that the discussion that started about these discrete crimes, because that's to call them what they are, crimes, has, and the anger about police brutality, which is, as you've said, is not a new problem, has turned into a larger discussion. I mean, about a lot of things, like Confederate flags are coming down, Confederate monuments are coming down, Christopher Columbus statues are coming down, like that stuff we have not really seen. And then you get into the defund the police thing, which is a very radioactive slogan and a very radical anarchistic sounding slogan. But what it really means, I think, to at least some people who are saying it, is it's not even just the police. In fact, I was just reading a Times story from a couple of years ago that the U.S. is one of the only country, it might be the only industrialized country in the world or whatever you want to say, that spends more on its prison system than it does on its policing system. I'm not sure if that's totally still true because that article is 2 or 3 years old. But I think when people are, that slogan to me at least doesn't mean destroy the police department so there's no police. It means if you spend X billions of dollars right now on both prisons and police, let's just say you can't touch that, that X billion has to be the same. Like the unions and the interests are too strong. The corporate interest, the prison industry is too strong to fight them. Okay, fine. How can we take that X millions and instead of spending it on the prison system as we know it, spend it on programs like the one you just talked about in Cheshire, which are all over the country in various incubation stages. And instead of spending it on, outfitting the police as if they are paramilitary units trying to kill bin Laden, outfitting the police with skills to go into their, the police were not imagined as a paramilitary unit. The police were imagined as the thing that would protect you and be part of the community and be part of the community from the ground up. If the discussion veers that way, that is a really interesting and healthy discussion and touches on everything you've been doing for Vera.
Zach, look, and you make excellent points. It's crazy to me that whenever it's something with the black and brown community or to drive real change to move the narrative, it's always a right-wing thing, a left-wing thing. It's never about what's right and what's wrong. But when you look at all the social injustices, a fractured system, and you see things that continue to find resources, the communities don't find these resources. The programming that's needed to address some of the trauma and the issues that we're dealing with, they never seem to find resources. Not until now, and that's why I'm proud of all my people from all walks of life that got out there and unified and said, the system is fractured. We're protesting. We need to address these issues. And you touched on something. The centuries of trauma, when you talk about mass incarceration, you talk about the Willie Lynch, you talk about old Jim Crow, new Jim Crow, the civil rights movement, redlining, environmental racism, all these things. Now you are addressing things in real time and trying to expedite the process to say, you know what, America, we feel you. We hear you. We know some of these issues we need to address. But the headline is defunding the police. But it's defunding a lot of other things that don't probably necessarily need the funding because it's some things that has no funding. You know what I mean? Like, I think about community centers and rec centers that got great fatherhood initiatives and all these things. One that we run that had to partner up with a YMCA. You know, it was a GoFundMe page and people in the community felt like, well, you know, city council felt like this community center wasn't important. So if you have over 200 kids coming here on a daily basis from the black and brown community, disenfranchised community, and all of a sudden this community center is no longer here, where the hell are they going to go? They're going to be in the street.
So when I was covering the criminal justice system in Connecticut, actually, for about the last year of the job, I was lucky enough to get access to a couple things. One was I went to a prison reentry support group every Wednesday night in Bridgeport, where 10 guys, all guys, probably 9 of them black guys, would get together and they had either just been released or were in a halfway house environment where they got permission to come to this group. And they would just talk about the issues that they were going to face and how many family members had kind of snubbed them and weren't accepting them back and how hard it was to get hired. And these groups are just like, there's volunteers bringing food. There's a guy whose full-time job is something else who gives up his evenings to be the counselor who's talking to these guys. And like, these are the groups that need funding and support because these are the people. And also those halfway houses that I mentioned. I mean, part of there are some states that in the last 5 years has actually lowered their prison population. And part of the way they've done that is, okay, you're a nonviolent offender or whatever. You're a year out from your sentence being over. We're going to gradually transition you back into society by putting you in a halfway house environment where you're going to get a job, but you have to sleep in this house with a couple of other ex-inmates. And you're going to, and so it's not just such a stark transition from prison to life like that, particularly if you've been in prison for a long time. Like, I'm a big believer that that stuff works, but it's all money. It's all money and it's all time and it needs staff and it needs people. And like, it's nothing fancy. It's just money and it's work. And if you, that's the stuff that you can't give up on that stuff. If a year or two goes by and the evidence is like, well, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, or it kind of works, or there was one bad case that didn't go, like, that's the stuff you have to keep fighting for.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, Zach. And look, it's certain jobs that need great people and people that's authentic and understand that the cause and the passion is way bigger than them. And just like the police force, there's certain jobs that, you know, you can't have bad apples. Flight attendants and pilots. You can't have a bad apple being a pilot.
You can't have a bad apple carrying military grade weaponry around towns.
Yeah. You can't have a bad apple in certain jobs, just like the halfway houses. You have to have people that truly authentic and have passion about the transition process of pouring into these men, young men and women that's coming out in transition phases, trying to be a better version of them and help guide them. Because if you have bad apples in those situations, it can be a death sentence for a lot of people. So I think that's important also. So making sure that the right people and the resources to these programs are available, you know, for society, because it's a domino effect for everyone. It will affect all of us one way or another.
So part of the reason I think your story is one of hope is, so you're a black kid born in Racine, where probably, I think you said less than 10% of the population is black or something like that, right? Absolutely. You're like a very distinct minority. Yeah. Probably a lot of the police force is white, right? Father is not there. You start getting in trouble when you're 10, 11 years old, doing real drugs, going to jail, everything. It's going badly for you. Then you clean up. This one instance where you get in and your mom follows you, decide, I'm not doing the same work. Get a job at Burger King. Start working, doing everything that you're supposed to do, right? And one day, with all that progress going on, the police show up at the house you're living in. I don't know if it was your house, but the house you're living in.
Yeah.
And they raid it. And they find something. And you've told this story before, so forgive me. But I want you to tell that story because 9 times out of 10, that is the end for Caron Butler, because you just happen to be there and they find some drugs. So please tell an audience who may not know that story what happened.
Yeah, so we was in a drug infested neighborhood on Bluff. It was 1209 Bluff Avenue. And we was renting out a property. And what happens in these neighborhoods, for people that's slow on game, is that when you're in these neighborhoods, you may have like crowds of people on different corners and transactions happen. And we was in the midst and the gut of it, the heart of it. And a lot of times people would put like baggies or Dorito bags or whatever, 25-cent quarter juices, all that, and have drugs stashed in it and put it on the side of the curb. You know, because it's a drug infested neighborhood, if the police had jumped out, the jump out boys had come, it can be anybody's. So you can't really get charged with possession, but you get charged with being in the vicinity of drugs, maybe violation of parole or whatever the case. So fast forward to this day where I was actually at home sick. I left school and I'm upstairs on the second floor.
What are you, 17, 18, something like that?
I was 17 at the time.
Okay, so you're up on the second floor.
Yeah, I'm second floor, 17 years old, laying down. And I actually thought that it was someone coming in the house trying to rob the house because, you know, my uncle was still, you know, in the streets, involved in that life, kind of, you know, halfway in, halfway out. And I hear boom, boom. And it's no one announcing themselves yet. I don't hear police. I don't hear ATF. I don't hear anything. And the doors kicked in. So immediately I just covered up. You know, I was just like, man, damn, like whatever's going to happen, going to happen. And I heard all the footsteps and everything. And then I recognized that it was the police because I heard the type of chatter and the conversation and the radios. And, you know, I just protected myself, got hit by the ATF, stripped out, pulled out, ransacking the whole house. They go outside, and on the premises, they found over 1.5 ounces of hard crack cocaine. So I'm looking at this situation, and I'm thinking about my priors. Everyone knows what happened in these instances. A black man in a drug raid, in a car, in a vicinity of drugs. I was on probation. If I was convicted of this crime, I just want the listeners and viewers to understand this, I would have got 10 to 15 years.
And that's it. That's it. Basketball over.
No, like, nothing. I'm gone. 10 to 15, yeah. Guaranteed, because that was my cap rate because of my priors. So I'm handcuffed, and I'm sitting there in the living room, and they come. They was like, bingo, we got it. They come from the back. And I was like, got what? And they like, look, this was in the back. I said, that's not mine. Handcuffed, mind you, sitting in a chair in the living room. My mom and the whole entire school is outside. This is at a time where I'm at the height of my basketball career as a high school player. So everybody, the word traveled quickly. My high school is literally one block away. All the whole high school is in front of my house. Everybody. I'm talking about the whole school, hundreds of kids. And they say, yo, we got them. I hear the chatter. Yeah, we found it. It's in the house. They're on the porch. Everybody, you can hear the crowd like, no, that was set up. You know, people. And I'll never forget the detective. He took his mask off because they all had masks on, ATF unit. He took his mask off, and that's alcohol, tobacco, and firearm. He took his mask off, and he started, like, talking to me just, like, as a human being. He wasn't addressing me or, you know, just sending me off as, like, yo, we got him, take him to jail, put him in the rap van. He was like, how was your day today? Like, what? Why are you at home? You know, tell me about yourself. And we start having a conversation. And he stood up, and he walked over to the corner, like, of the house, and he started having a conversation with two other officers. And then he gets on the radio and talked to his superior. And he came back to me, and he said, I want you to know that I'm going to keep an eye on you going forward. So I'm like, what the hell? Like, and he, no, bro, no, Zach, this is so deep, bro, because he's like, I'm going to keep an eye on you going forward. I'm like, oh, you going to watch me in prison? Like, I don't get what you're saying. And he unhandcuffed me, and he said, we're going to, you know, finish up in the house, and then y'all can come back in the house when it's done. And I came out. Crowd was clapping, all type. My mom was crying because they already had said, we got it. It's bingo. Like, he's in the house, and they just knew the situation. But I was released, and the officer name was Sergeant Rick Geller, who I am great friends with still to this day. We have a strong relationship. We've been conversating. We traveled all around the world together, speaking to law enforcement from Sacramento to the White House, everything, champions of change. And, yeah, that was just a mind blowing experience right there.
So, one of the versions of this story that I read was he starts asking you questions. And one of the questions is, hey, you have a burn on your arm or something. How did you get that? And you said, well, I work at Burger King, you know, I'm working with the fryer or whatever. Then they searched your pockets or something, and they found $11. And he said to himself, well, $11, a drug dealer is going to have more than $11 cash in his pocket. And you know why? It's a story of hope to me, because it sounds so dumb, but like, that's what being a police officer should be. Like, that's a dude being a human being and using his skills and his intuition and looking at you like a human being and not the target of a raid. Like, looking at you in the face, in the eyes, assessing the situation, using his judgment and experience and making a decision that, you know what, like, I don't gotta be super duper hard ass on every single one. I can look at each situation discreetly and make a judgment, and like, that's good policing, and good policing exists. And like, if that guy's not a good police officer that day, I don't know that Caron Butler is in the NBA and on this podcast and anything. And like, not giving him credit for your story, because your story is yours and your basketball career is yours, but like, that guy's a different guy, and I don't know what happens. You know what I mean?
He's 100% different, and I think that he needs to continue to be involved by leading, because what happened now, and I want to get to this point too. Another thing, which was great detective work, is that he continued to say over two or three times that he does not fit the description of the reason why we are raiding his house. Because whenever you kick down a door or get the right to do a search for a property, you have to get that signed off by a judge. And the judge has signed off because it was a transaction that came out that house prior, you know, to that day. And I did not fit the description. You know what I mean? So he was like, he don't even fit the description of the individual. And that was this, you know, great policing, you know, done by him. But I think that the real problem, Zach, in these communities and communities that I come from, still come from, you know, is that the people that's from the community is not patrolling the community. That is a big problem. So immediately you're coming 30 to 40 miles out, coming in to patrol a community that you already have this narrative about and you're terrified of. So immediately when something happens that you're uncomfortable with, you overreact. You know what I mean? Like, you're overreacting. Like, today I'm flying to Wisconsin, to, like I always do, celebrate Juneteenth Day. I've been doing that for 21 years straight. But also to celebrate the life of Tyrese West, who's one of the names that's in Minneapolis on the ground. He was gunned down in Racine. It was an overkill situation. This kid was part of the Butler Elite program. And I want to make sure that his legacy, his memory goes on, but he was killed after 11 o'clock at night while jumping off a bicycle. And he was shot down. And he was shot two times in the head. And his case is still being investigated. But I bring you to this point. There's no reason why he should not be here. Even if he jumped off a bike and you couldn't catch him that day or whatever, it wasn't no reason for lethal force to be used in this situation. So I think that the policing and the tactics have to change.
Well, and the point you made about hiring from local places, I mean, there are ways to incentivize all those things. There are ways you can use money and budgets to in tax breaks and everything too. And like we were talking about prison reentry before, and one of the things I'm very passionate about is you've got to find some way to encourage businesses to hire people who have come out of prison. Because you know how it goes. You get a resume, like, oh, looks good. Oh, prison. Oh, out. Just throw it in the bin, throw it in the bin. This guy could be a great guy. Could have been one mistake. Could have been one stupid mistake like we all make when we're 18, 17, 21, whatever it is. And you can't get a job. And if you can't, and because these companies, oh, I don't know. I can find another guy who's not coming out of prison. If we don't wrap our arms around the people who deserve it. Now, not everyone coming out of prison deserves it. Some people have done stuff that is maybe unforgivable. But if you deserve it, if we don't wrap our arms around those people, and that includes tax breaks maybe that encourage companies to do this, other incentives that encourage companies, if we don't wrap our arms around those people, we are setting them up to fail. And that's not their fault. That's our fault.
I totally agree with that. And, you know, I've had so many family members, so many loved ones that come out of, you know, tough situations that hit some adversity, and they're trying to get on the right path. They beyond educated. They got the high school equivalency diploma or the GED while they was away, or took whatever classes and the necessary steps to pick up traits, whether it's welding or whatever, and they get out and they're overqualified for the jobs. And to your point, immediately they're rejected because of a prior. How many people that you know in life have made a bad decision? And you should not be held hostage for the rest of your life for a bad decision. If you learn from your decision, if you're committed to being a better version of you, if the consistency shows, like, you deserve another shot. You've paid your debt to society. You should be able to move forward.
Well, particularly as a black kid in America, your bar for what is a quote-unquote bad decision is much lower than my bar as a white kid in America for what is a bad decision. Your bar for a bad decision might be looking at a police officer the wrong way one day, having a joint in your pocket, which, by the way, how many white kids at prep school and college are having that same thing? So your bar for that, I mean, I saw too many black kids to count. In fact, it was so depressing, there's the reason why I left the job, who just for smoking pot when they were 15 years old. You know how it starts. You're in, and then you're in, and then it's hard to get out. And all of this is policy, right? And this reminded me yesterday, LeBron and Jalen Rose, and Skylar Diggins announced this voting initiative to try and get particularly young black people to vote in the upcoming election and going forward. And you're reading these stories about, this is an aside, but it's just something in my head. You're reading these stories about how this Supreme Court case like 5 years ago kind of rolled back the Voting Rights Act, like the landmark Voting Rights Act. Then they're just like the Voting Rights Act of 1965. 1965 in the scheme of human history is like yesterday. And that is when like the Voting Rights Act happened. So when you start talking about like systemic racism and blah, 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 and you're met with skepticism from people who are like, well, slavery was 400 years ago. How is that so? Slavery ended 160 years ago. That's essentially yesterday. And all of this landmark civil rights legislation that dealt away with policies that we all agree are like embarrassingly backward, like not even embarrassingly backward, like retrograde, immoral, awful. That's like 60 years. Like people were alive when that happened. Like, so for people it's just been in my head because I keep seeing on Twitter, well, how can you still argue systemic racism? It's not like, how can you not? We're all still living the consequences of all that stuff right now.
Yeah, we're products of a fractured system that have not been addressed. And how naive of America to think that something that was created in 1965 that I'm pretty sure a black and brown person was not on the seat of any of those that's at the table at any of those decision making things, you know, for the culture to feel like that should still be in existence till today. Like it's mind blowing and eye popping to me. And what I would say is in order for real change, like people have to understand, I read something that it said the black and brown community are looking for equality. We're not asking for revenge. We're just asking for equality. And that's the realest thing. Like people not saying, yo, we'll get to that. But the centuries of, you know, oppression and everything that we sacrificed and our ancestors sacrificed, we're just looking for equality and we're still on that quest.
The other event that I wanted to ask you to elaborate on, because it's, I was getting nervous reading it, is, you're working at Burger King. You're on probation. You're wearing a monitoring bracelet, I think, right?
Yeah.
Around your ankle. And whoever's supposed to pick you up from Burger King.
My mom.
Is not available for some reason. And the story that I read was you look at your watch and you're like, I got 30 minutes to get home or this bracelet is going to start beeping and people are going to realize this dude's not where you're supposed to be. And I'm X miles from my house. I better freaking run. Is that like in my head? I'm stressed out thinking about that. So you had to run like a 6 minute mile for like several miles to get home and you made it, I think, right?
Bro, I made it and I got right into my range at the appropriate time. So I'm sitting here looking and, you know, I didn't have a cell phone or anything like that. And my mom was supposed to be there to pick me up. So I called my grandmother. Cause I think my mom just forgot. She's been working. They used to call her Miss Overtime. Cause all she did is work overtime. So she picked up another shift and, I called my grandmother on the phone inside Burger King payphones. For those who don't know what that is, it's in a phone booth, what the thing Superman used to jump in and change. So I got on the payphone and I'm like, Grandma, did you see mom? Or you, she's like, oh, she's still at work. She ain't gonna get out till like 10. So I look at the clock and I was like, can you come get me? She was like, oh baby, your uncle took my car. I was like, Grandma, I gotta be home in like 29 minutes. I'll never forget. I was like, I gotta be home in like 29 minutes. She said, baby, please run, get home. And I took off and like, bro, I ran so hard just so that monitor would not go off because I'm gonna tell you, my parole officer was just different. This, the smallest infraction, I'm telling you, like if I was 5 minutes late, it'd be like, you don't want your freedom. You don't, like, no, I'm running from work. Like I couldn't get a ride. The bus, like all that, I just didn't have access to that. So I had to run and it took me, I had to run like four miles and I made it.
And it sounds like a funny story. And on a little bit of a level, it is a funny story. It's actually quite a scary story because That's just an innocent mix-up involving an overworked mom and a kid trying to get home from his job. And if your parole officer doesn't see it as an innocent mix-up or doesn't care, just doesn't care, that's another moment where it's like it's a moment where things could just go the other way. It's actually not a funny story at all when you think about it.
Yeah, she would not have even listened to my explanation or my reason. I'm gonna blow you away with this. So Nike had came in. This is at the time where AAU and grassroots basketball had got extremely popular. Nike had came in and sponsored this program at the Bray Center, and I was pretty good at the time, and it was a chance of a lifetime, and I had to take a chance. I had to take a risk, and this the first Zach. This is the first time I told this story. I needed to go travel on the AAU basketball circuit, so I found out a way to take off my home monitor. And my parole officer, we went to her with, like, I showed her, like, my grades, my progress reports, everything. All A's and B's. I had no small infractions, nothing. I said, look, I need to travel with this team for 2 days to go to Indiana. And if I go to Indiana, I probably can get a scholarship for college, like, and have a shot at life. Like, this, I got a really good talent. I don't care. You have 6 more months of probation. I said, look, I'm going. This is my chaperone. This is this. We went to the table. So fast forward. I said, you know what? I just can't go. My uncle, who was clever, he figured out a way to get the monitor off. It was a little loose. He pulled it off, unscrewed it, kept it in the house. And every once in a while, somebody just moved around the house with it. So I stayed at, I left the monitor there. I went to Gary, Indiana, and played in this, I think it was a speech jam or the spice tournament at Purdue University. I end up averaging like 30 points a game. I played against the number one player in the country at the time, which was Darius Miles and all those guys. And that's how I came on the scene. And that's how my basketball career got life. That moment right there.
So I'm empathetic is too strong a word. Okay, so the parole officer is the clear villain in this story, right? And so, but what people, okay, she sounds like a bad parole officer. Let me just get that straight. Even good parole officers might make decisions like that because they've got 500 cases that they're in charge of at the same time. You're just one. They just want to get home to dinner and see their family, and like they just don't have the bandwidth to make these individualized decisions that are the right decisions. Like a good parole officer sits down in that situation and makes the right decision, and that's all the more reason why whatever the funding, whatever the way to make it work, the caseloads need to be lower and the people in the jobs need to be better, because that is a decision that's an easy one that has a kid's got a shot at it, and you can't just look at the sheet of paper, no, next, no, Karan, you gotta stay home next. Like, it's just whatever. That's a hell of a story. Good for your uncle.
Bro. Yeah, man. My uncle Richard, he took care of me. And, you know, the system is so fractured, as I touched on numerous times in this interview. My uncle Carlos, after I went to the NBA, we had a nice house, and, you know, it was together, and the parole officer literally came out to the site check and just like, nah, you can't be on probation staying here. You can't be on house arrest in this house. You got to find somewhere else to live. Just because the circumstances was too nice. You know, she felt like he needed to have a little more struggle and a little more whatever. And I'm just like, that is her observation and that's her decision. And we couldn't get a new case manager, couldn't get a new parole officer. We fought the case, and it's still, you know, friends are friends. They all run together. It was just one of those situations. So those are the type of people that are trying to help people that's trying to, you know, transition back into society.
For some people, the cruelty is the point. Well, look, it's nothing but work, and you've been doing the work before this recent spate of activity and protest, and you're going to keep doing the work after, and it's just work, and it's just your time, and I admire that, and I think more of us need to devote more of our time. Can I ask you a few basketball questions before I let you go?
Oh, absolutely.
Let's, because we have to talk about some fun things. Well, this actually isn't fun, but you're well connected to players now that are still in the league. I mean, you just retired, like, again, yesterday. the noise is starting to come out now that the players are getting a little uncomfortable with what the quarantine is going to be like in Orlando. You talk to a lot of guys. How much discomfort is there? What are they uncomfortable about?
Well, you know, it's a lot of uncertainties because, you know, I think that being isolated from your loved ones and what are considered essentials, you know, for a extended period of time in a bubble is just, you know, something that's unfamiliar to everyone. But at the same time, we're in unfamiliar grounds and territories, you know, as a whole in the midst of this pandemic. And I think that when you look at the urgency to get back, the NBA has taken all the precaution and all the necessary steps to put everyone in the safest environment as possible. And in order to do that, you know, you can't control others, you know, and that's, you know, one of the big concerns and issues. So players just having a hard time wrapping their mind around that at this point, but they also understand the revenue situation and all that. So it's also an urgency for that. Like, this is a piece of the puzzle, but I think that Zach, I've been skeptical to even go to the grocery store at times. My wife and I'd be like, why are you sending me? You know what I mean? Like, why I got to be the one? Because I'm the oldest in the house.
My wife doesn't let me go. You know why? She's like, you're too stupid. You're going to be in there. You don't know where anything is. You're going to be in there for three times as long as me, and you're going to come back having forgotten half the stuff. So I'm banned from going to the grocery store.
But I think that is the thing. Like, we've been isolated and locked down for 4 months now. So, like, whenever you're asked to do anything, it's going to be like, why should I do that? Or why? It's going to be questions. You know what I mean? But I think once everyone gets there, I think that the energy and the environment is going to have a life of its own to take over all the questions, because you're going to compete. You're going to, you know, go at each other. You know, I think the basketball component is just going to take over everything.
Do you think if they play the national anthem, and if the national anthem is televised, do you think players will kneel?
It's possibly. You know, I haven't talked to anyone personally, but I just think that, you know, considering the current climate of the country and where everybody's at, I wouldn't be surprised to see any form of, you know, togetherness, you know, placed by the players. I wouldn't be shocked. It wouldn't shock me at all.
The NBA has a rule against it's not really a rule against kneeling. It's a rule about what you are supposed to do during the anthem, which is stand in an orderly fashion. They have in the past said that they would not waive that rule when this was an issue a couple of years ago. I would be shocked if they didn't waive that rule now. And if they don't, shame on them. Like, if the players want to kneel, if the players want to do anything, this is not the time to enforce. Talking about rules-based decision-making and black and white decision-making, if the players want to kneel, kneel. If you are remembered for one team, I think it's the Wizards, or the most memorable of, like, when people think of Caron Butler, the first team they think of is probably Washington. Wizards with Anton Jameson, you and Gilbert Arenas. You faced LeBron three times in a row in the playoffs. LeBron and the Cavs three times in a row. One, the middle year, you're injured, and Gil, I think, is also injured. 2008. I want you to just set this scene for me, because it's too good of an NBA scene. Washington, Cleveland, Deshaun Stevenson is guarding LeBron. Deshaun is your teammate at the time. Calls LeBron overrated in an interview and says, print that. LeBron is asked to respond and says, well, me responding to Deshaun Stevenson would be the equivalent of Jay-Z responding to Soulja Boy. This then becomes an entire thing where Soulja Boy is at the games and Jay-Z is writing a diss track about Deshaun Stevenson and the Washington Wizards. The story that is too good to be true, and you have to verify it. Are you actually in a club in Washington, D.C. when the DJ plays the diss track?
So I'm in a lounge with the Cleveland Cavaliers, myself, and probably two other teammates. Our city, D.C.
Yeah.
And they was like, yo, you know, the Cleveland Cavaliers in the building. I was like, all right, that's cool. That's dope. And all of a sudden, they like, yo, new Jay-Z on the mic. The MC is just saying the new Jay-Z. So I hear the Too Short beat come on, you know, blow your whistle. and that's the anthem at the time. So everybody like, hey, and all of a sudden it just started going on about who you think is overrated. And I was like, wait a minute. That sound familiar? And then it just went into the whole direction into, you know, my brother, Deshaun Stevenson. And I was just like, oh. So I immediately texted Deshaun and I told the owner of the club, I was like, you know how disrespectful this was as a player here in D.C. And, you know, we come here, we support you. You support us, and that was just a slap in the face. Oh, I didn't know what the song wasn't saying. I didn't, you know, so he pulled it. But, you know, for quite some time, you know, over a year or something, like, it was just some friction. Like, nobody went to any of his spots or supported him at some time. But it was just a crazy environment. I'll never forget that.
That's too good of a story. And the whole Cavs, people like the Cavs Wizards playoff series were like just before social media really, really took off. Today, that would have been the most anticipated first round series in the NBA.
Absolutely. We had a lot of antics.
Had a lot of antics. I have to know, when you see the Cavs at the club, are you going to interact with the Cavs, or is it just like we're in the middle of a playoff series? You sit over there, we sit over here. We mind our business.
It wasn't that type of like club. It was just a lounge where people went and just kind of chill. But at the same time, like in the midst of the playoffs, like I wasn't really talking to nobody. You know, that was just my thing. Like I would go somewhere, like. Go to the lounge, stay in there for about an hour and shoot out and go back. It was just, you know, just to be around people to, you know, keep your ear to the street, to see what people saying, like what we need to be doing better, because sometimes you get wrapped up in your own thoughts and, you know, just in the locker room talk that you need like some outside, you know, some interjection sometime. Absolutely. You know what I mean? Yeah. So like, you know, that's one of the reasons why I follow certain individuals on, you know, television. You know, this is a time where, you know, all you guys, you know, Mike Wilbon, so many more, like, that spoke the truth about situations and gave me a different observation, because sometimes if you're in an environment, you just don't have that observation. So you'd be like, oh, okay. Well, maybe we need to address that. You know what I mean? Like, to win this series or whatever the case may be. So I just wanted to be amongst the people. And that was a bad moment right there. But I will tell you, I would not have spoke to none of the Cavs players.
That's what I like to hear. Did you really have to hide your Mountain Dew habit from Kobe Bryant during your year with the Lakers?
Oh, 100%. Immediately. Because I started blackout sessions with Kobe right after he signed the contract. And he had signed the contract. We was working out every day, me, him, Joe. And fast forward to like our first game of the season, he was just like, man, you look good, your game sharp, but you be like getting winded sometime, like seem like you be huffing and puffing a little bit too much, man. You a Mercedes man, you a hybrid, you're supposed to be huffing and puffing like that. What type of fuel you using? And I was like, fuel? Like what? He was like, man, you gotta, you know, premium, like what you putting in your body? And I was like, man, I eat good. Like me thinking from, you know, from the South. You know, I eat good. You know, whatever I eat is good because it's good to me. You know what I mean? And we was on the bus and he comes in the back and I literally had like a Mountain Dew, a 1 liter, a 2 liter. I don't know what it was. And I immediately tried to hide it. And he saw it. He was like, man, come on, man. You can't be putting that in your body, man. What the hell you doing, CB? And from that moment, I was like, it. All right, I'm going to stop drinking Mountain Dew. And I just like pivoted away from Mountain Dew for probably about, what, the remainder of that season, which was probably, what, 5 months, 6 months. But the second that I went to Washington, I was back on that. I couldn't stop, man, but I held true to it. But I don't drink Mountain Dew no more, but I held true to it. You know, just I only drunk it in the third and fourth quarters.
Hey, look, whatever you need to get through crunch time. You know what I mean? Like, if it helps you get through crunch time, go for it. I don't care.
Zach, it was in all my Gatorade cups. Everybody else was asking for the new Gatorade Tiger and all that. I was like, go in my locker. Damn, the ball kids was like, go in your locker. I was like, put two ice cubes and put it in a Gatorade cup. Put the Mountain Dew in it. And, hey, 20.
As you say, did you tip them? Did you tip the ball kids? That's a big job.
Hey, okay. Mountain Dew and straws, buckets.
You told a story in something I read about walking on the – like seeing Kobe, watching Kobe watch film on the plane. And it was one of those – reading you talking about it, it was your moment of thinking, oh, wow, the stories are real. This guy, like, this isn't all trumped up. This is – so watching – so what was it like watching film with him?
So the best thing that ever happened for me is, like, the range of basketball insight that I got from – the legendary Max Good in prep school, Hall of Fame Jim Calhoun, the godfather of the game, Pat Riley, Eric Spoelstra, Stan Van Gundy. That was my introduction to basketball and how to evaluate. And they used to always tell me these stories and the game within the game and how to view and the slide overs and the rotations and what to watch out for. But I've never seen it from a player. You know, I'm like, yo, this is too much information. Like, it's so much. I get traded to Los Angeles and we're on the flight every time, or we land in the city. Like, if he's not at a gym, we're watching film and spending that time with each other. He was just the evaluation on what he was looking for and what he saw, the layers of the defense. And also he said, Karan, this is one of the most important things, knowing the other team sets. So as they prepare for you, you prepare for them. He said, that's how you make the all defensive teams. That's how you do all this stuff, because you know their sets better than them. Like, I recall being on the court with Kobe, and then I started having fun and doing it as well, because he would be on the court and tell a player, like, yo, you're in the wrong spot. Like, go over here. Like, the other player on the other team, like, tell the other guy to go over there. And also just – and I think he mentioned it in the Mamba mentality book, is that – you know, he read the referee's manual to find out, you know, pockets and holes in their system. Like, he was just different from his learning perspective. And also, if you wanted to learn, he would teach you. But people was fearful of that. People was afraid and intimidated by going next to him and, you know, being held accountable. But I loved it, man. And my big brother taught me so much about the game of basketball and also life.
Last thing I want to ask you, last team I want to ask you about, and then I'll let you go, is I remember – this is going to kind of be random, but I remember exactly where I was when you got hurt in 2011 with the Mavs. I believe it was in January, maybe late December, January.
January 1st,
because I was all over that Mavs team. I love that team, and you guys have gotten off to a great start. Now, you'd lost two in a row, I think, or something like that when you got hurt. But I remember thinking, boy, that team had something. They looked like they were going to be a real contender. I love the way the team was built. You got hurt, and I just remember the rest of the night, I was out somewhere with people that I should have been interacting with, and on my mind is like, okay, what's the trickle-down effect of Caron Butler being injured? Who's going to take his place? What does that do? The rotation, is this going to kill this Mavs team? Did you feel the same? Like, man, we had something going and now I don't know and I'm going to miss out?
Yeah, I felt like everything was in place. I'll never forget running down, no contact, patella tendon rupture. And immediately I go in the back. I had to get up on my own will, trying to bring the stretcher out for me. I was like, hell no. And this is in my hometown in Milwaukee. I had over 300 people.
Wow. At the game. I didn't know that. I didn't remember that.
Yeah, I had like 250, 300 people at the game. And I always did that, in Milwaukee, and I go in the back, Mark Cuban comes back, and I'm like, bro, it's bad. I've never felt like this. Like, it's really bad. And he told me, don't worry about it. You're part of this team. Hey, bro, you're one of our leaders. You're not going nowhere. So I didn't have to worry about anything but staying true to our mission. So immediately when the guys came in, Dirk was looking like what happened? I was like, no, don't worry about it. We good. Just keep playing. Keep, you know, everybody just stay on the same page. And Rick Carlisle had a heart-to-heart with me, and he said, I want you to continue to do everything you did, all the other things. I know you can't participate in the games and all that stuff for quite some time, but just do all the other stuff that you did, because we need that leadership. And that's what I did. And I felt like everyone just got re-energized. I saw J.J. Barea be different. I saw Jet be different. And Jason Kidd made a promise to me that, we're going to keep this thing going for you. And all those guys, they rallied around me instead of, you know, soaking in our sorrows or whatever, you know, other teams may do. Like, they stay committed to the mission.
I do feel like, to an unusual degree, for a guy who was injured and didn't play in the playoffs, that everyone, not only within that team, but people evaluating your career and your place on that team, view you as, no, that guy's a part of the team. That guy's a champion, just like the rest of us. Some guys get injured, and even if they're starters and the team wins, they're sort of forgotten about it. You see them at the ring ceremony, you're like, oh yeah, that guy was on the team. Well, congrats. You were really embraced, I think, by fans and members of the team, and fans outside Dallas. Caron Butler is a champion as much as anybody else on that team. They made you feel that, it seems like.
No, I did my part. You know, I think that immediately what happens is that I didn't take that situation and just disconnect from my obligation. You know, it was the next man up, but it also was, I had a different role now. I had to, one, embrace my role, and then also continue to lead by my rehab. And I was always the first one, last one to leave. I was doing all the extra stuff. I was, you know, in participating in film session, talking more than everybody, letting them know that this is what I see. The things that I learned from Kobe and Pat Riley and everyone that I played for and with, just giving them my insight and being extremely vocal and whatever I can do. And that's how you have your fingerprints on the big goal and of, you know, winning a championship success. And I'm going to tell you, it took everything in me, you know, Zach, to, you know, get through all of that. And that's the ultimate sacrifice. And people always say, well, I know I was a hell of a player. I know I was talented, and I know that probably would have been even sweeter if I played, but I still had my fingerprints on the success of that team and that championship run. So I wouldn't have it any other way. I wouldn't change because I know the outcome. We won. So that's ultimately the end game anyway.
You won, and it's a team that I think is near and dear to a lot of, like, neutral fans' hearts. People love that team for lots of different reasons. Anyway, you've got to go. You've got work to do. Caron, you're right. You had a great career, but what you're doing now is more important. And I encourage people, follow Caron on Twitter, Real Tough Juice, TUFF. You've been doing, you'll see it on Instagram. You'll see you've been doing these NBA Together chats, roundtable discussions about COVID in prisons, COVID in the Latin community, police brutality, like real stuff. And again, I applaud you because it's time. And all of us are pressed for time, and not enough of us put enough time, me included, put enough time into actually doing this stuff. And it's hard work, and you're doing it, and you're doing it every day, every year. It just keeps going. So I applaud you for that, and I think everyone should follow you, and I appreciate you coming on.
Hey, likewise, brother. I appreciate you giving me a platform to just, you know, tell my truth and be authentic. And, you know, thanks for your knowledge as well, man. You know, I know that you've, you know, done the research, you're educated in this space. And I think my last thing that I would leave the listeners and viewers with is just educate yourself, get informed, get over informed so you can inform properly. Because as you said, you directed people to my social media accounts. It's a lot of people that have accounts that, you know, post things, but make sure that what you're posting, that you're informed about the information that you're posting as well, because you don't want to wrongfully inform anybody.
Caron Butler, thank you very much. I'll see you down the line. Stay healthy and stay safe.
Likewise, brother.